First You Think is a not-for-profit ministry of the First Unitarian Church of Des Moines. Support us at ucdsm.org today.
4 weeks ago in the sermon called Believing, Really Believing, and Talking to Your Car, I mentioned that psychology professor Lisa Feldman Barrett argues that emotions are constructed. There are, she says, two main biological continua. There's the pleasant to unpleasant continuum, and there's the high arousal to low arousal continuum. For low arousal and pleasant, think of blissful calm. For high arousal and pleasant, think of something really fun and exciting. For high arousal and unpleasant, think of being very scared or anxious. And for low arousal and unpleasant, think of being bored. The rich and subtle texture of our emotional lives is then a matter of using learned concepts to interpret our biological states in socially recognized ways. Today, I wanted to go back to that earlier point and say a bit more about that. Our emotions are a huge part of what we are. What are they? Where do they come from? What do they mean? What are we to do with them? Consider, for example, a feeling that you might have had, though you didn't have a name for it. Lisa Feldman Barrett describes it. Imagine the feeling of reaching into a bag of potato chips and discovering that the previous chip you ate was the last one. You feel disappointed that the bag is empty, and yet relieved that you won't be ingesting any more calories. You feel slightly guilty that you ate the entire bag, and yet hungry for another chip. So a mix of feelings, disappointment yet relief, a hint of guilt yet desire for more. Dr. Barrett gives this made-up emotion a name. She calls it chiplessness. What makes an emotion is that we learn to interpret our body states with some category. We use those categories to interpret other people's feelings as well as our own. So the categories constitute a social reality. If you have feelings of love, well, you wouldn't know that feeling was love if you didn't have lots of examples from other people. So chiplessness becomes a real emotion to just the extent that it becomes a social reality, that we learn from each other to understand our body states with that category. The empty potato chip bag is the paradigm, but the emotion could apply to other cases. Anytime you're enjoying something that comes to an end and you're disappointed and relieved and a little guilty because you think maybe you've been enjoying it more than you should, and you're desirous for more at the same time, that's chiplessness. If you've ridden the roller coaster in a given amusement park hundreds of times and you get there one day and the ride is closed for repairs, you're disappointed and yet also a bit relieved because you feel a little bit guilty about the way you've been a touch overenthusiastic about this ride, and yet there's still a part of you that did want to ride it, so you're feeling chipless. Or you come to the end of the last episode of a series you've been binge-watching, and you're relieved that you got all the way through it, yet at the same time, sorry that it's over, and you suspect maybe spending all that time on this show may not have been the best use of your time, and yet you hope that there's going to be another season. You've got that chipless feeling. If you interpret your experience with this category a few times, it won't be long before you are adept at it. And now it's a real emotion, as real as happiness, sadness, anger, or fear. You might be thinking this new concoction is surely a mix of more elemental emotions. The feeling that something is bittersweet is a combination of bitterness and sweetness. The feeling of awe, says the Oxford Dictionary, is a feeling of reverential respect mixed with fear or wonder. Even supposedly opposite feelings can be mixed, like happiness and sadness at the same time. If you saw the 1997 Roberto Benigni film, Life is Beautiful, in which a father tries to keep his child's spirits up while they are in a concentration camp, then you probably got a strong dose of happiness and sadness at the same time. The masters of literature evoke the various mixing of emotions as their stock in trade, as a 1960 New Yorker column by John Updike about witnessing the baseball great Ted Williams's last at-bat. Updike wrote, "No other player visible to my generation has concentrated within himself so much of the sport's poignance, has so assiduously refined his natural skills, has so constantly brought to the plate that intensity of competence that crowds the throat with joy." Emotions can certainly be mixed, but let's examine this idea that mixtures are ultimately made up of elemental primary emotions. The supposed primary emotions are generally identified with some lists such as fear, anger, sadness, happiness, and disgust. Those are the five internal characters inside the psyche of 11-year-old Riley in the 2015 Pixar movie Inside Out. When I'm encouraging people to identify their emotions and separate the emotion from judgment and evaluation, I start with what I say are the basics: mad, sad, glad, and scared. How are you feeling, I might ask. And I might hear, I feel wronged or neglected or cheated or abandoned or betrayed or let down. Those are judgments. If you say you feel disappointed, that's getting closer, but in a given context, it's likely to be tinged with judgment about another person's conduct rather than your own emotion. So to be helpful in identifying the emotion, I might ask, are you mad, sad, glad, or scared? And from there, we can begin learning how to fine-tune our identification of emotions. Under the general rubric of sadness, one might discern discouragement, distraughtness, resignation, helplessness, hopelessness, misery, despair, grief, sorrow, or anguish, each of which is distinct. Anger might be fine-tuned as annoyance, frustration, exasperation, argumentativeness, bitterness, vengefulness, or fury. Gladness might be fine-tuned as sensory pleasure, rejoicing, compassionate joy, amusement, relief, pride, wonder, excitement, ecstasy, and so on. Psychologist Paul Ekman did a number of cross-cultural studies in which he showed photos of facial expressions like or. And Ekman's work led him to the conclusion that there were six emotions that were innate and universally recognized in all cultures: mad, sad, glad, scared, plus disgust, and also surprise. Another source lists eight primary emotions, leaving out sadness, but including distress and anxiety, as well as interest. Despite ongoing ambiguity about the precise list of what the primary emotions supposedly are, various writers confidently declare that primary emotions are universal and innate. Turns out, according to Lisa Feldman Barrett and a growing number of researchers whose evidence I find pretty persuasive, that none are universal or innate. None. What is universal and innate in the area of feelings are those two axes, low arousal to high arousal, and pleasant to unpleasant. That's the biology that is indeed basic, basic to all vertebrates and possibly to many invertebrates. Everything else, it turns out, is cultural and learned. We had to learn how to interpret ourselves and each other as angry or scared. We learned it basically the way we learned a few minutes ago to interpret ourselves sometimes as chipless. The classic facial expression that Ekman thought were cross-culturally universal: surprise, anger, disgust, happiness, etc. Those are stereotypes, and they are problematic in the way that stereotypes generally are. In the attempt to abstract or summarize, they misrepresent the complex reality. Ekman's photos were not of people who were feeling the emotion supposedly pictured. They were people who were told to show an assigned emotion, so they displayed the stereotype. In reality, People who are angry have all kinds of facial configurations. Maybe sometimes you quietly seethe. Other times you might be screaming and shouting, which would look more like an open mouth than a very tight-lipped closed mouth. If professional actors made the faces like the ones pictured above, we would think that their character was either intentionally being campy or that they were ham actors. In real life, if you saw someone with stereotypical surprise face or the fear face or any of the stereotyped ones, you would be more likely to think they were mocking the feeling than that they were authentically feeling it. And we'll explore more along those lines after our interlude. Careful studies measuring facial muscle movements find that there is no facial configuration, no part of a facial configuration that all angry people display, nor is there any part of a facial configuration that only angry people display. Sometimes those pursed tight lips are just someone thinking hard about something. When we dig a little into Paul Ekman's methodology, we learn that when he showed his pictures, like the ones that display the stereotyped emotions to people in remote cultures, he didn't just say, "What is this person feeling?" He presented the question as multiple choice. Choose the word that best matches the face. And the options were limited to Ekman's six. They might not have been the emotions that in that culture were the most central or primary. Members of a culture in which chiplessness was central and primary to their way of understanding themselves, if there were such a culture, would not have found chipless an available option. Moreover, in cultures that didn't speak English, Ekman had to use translations of the English words, even if close matches to the English word didn't exist in the other language. The Kung people of the Kalahari don't have any word for fear. They certainly feel the heightened adrenaline from an immediately imposed danger, and they will flee from it, and we would characterize them as afraid, but that's not how they think of themselves. And since part of the experience of fear is recognizing this is fear, they don't have the experience that we have. Utka Eskimos have no concept of anger. The Tahitians have no concept of sadness. Maybe that's because they're in Tahiti. You might think, as one writer put it, that a smile is recognized in all cultures as a signal of happiness and social welcome. Actually, no. Here's what Dr. Barrett says about that. For one thing, happiness is usually the only pleasant emotion category that's tested using the basic emotion method, so it's trivial for subjects to distinguish it from the negative categories. And consider this fun fact. The historical record implies that ancient Romans did not smile spontaneously when they were happy. The word smile doesn't exist in Latin. Smiling was an invention of the Middle Ages, and broad, toothy-mouthed smiles became popular only in the 18th century as dentistry became more accessible and affordable. Classics scholar Mary Beard adds, "This is not to say that Romans never curled up the edges of their mouths in a formation that would look to us much like a smile. Of course they did, but such curling did not mean very much in the range of significant social and cultural gestures in Rome. Conversely, other gestures, which would mean little to us, were much more heavily freighted with significance." Thus, Barrett concludes, "So far as I know, no emotion concept is universal. But even if one were, universality itself does not automatically imply a perceiver-independent reality. Take, for example, magical little people called nymphs in ancient Greece, leprechauns in Ireland, brownies in Scotland, fairies in Celtic legend, menehune in native Hawaiian folklore, trolls in Scandinavia, aziza in Africa, aglulik in Inuit culture, mimis in Aboriginal Australia, shin from China, kami from Japan. Even if magical little people were part of every single human culture on Earth, that wouldn't mean they were a perceiver-independent reality like atoms and rocks and trees. We're not saying emotions aren't real. We're saying they are cultural. And they are very real, just like money is very real, which also isn't a perceiver-independent reality, but depends on the social agreement of a given society. Other than those two axes of arousal and pleasantness, everything else in the area of emotion depends on having the concept, and concepts are learned features of a culture. Not all cultures have the emotion concepts of English-speaking cultures. Instead, they may have others. Of course, cultures sometimes borrow from each other, the way that English speakers have borrowed, examples I've mentioned before, Schadenfreude and Weltschmerz from the German, ennui from the French. Here are 17 others we might consider appropriating. From Italian, fiero, the enjoyment felt when you've met a challenge that stretched your capabilities. From Yiddish, naches, feelings of pride in the accomplishment or something, sometimes just the existence of your offspring or mentees. From the Dutch, gezellig and voorpret. Gezellig is a specific experience of comfort with friends. Voorpret is pleasure felt about an event before the event takes place, a delighted anticipation. From the Greek, stenohoria, a feeling of doom, hopelessness, suffocation, and constriction. From the Korean, jaeong, happiness, specifically from attachment to a close friend. From the Ilonggot of the Philippines, liget, exuberant aggression involving intense focus, passion, and energy while pursuing a hazardous challenge with a group of people. It sounds similar to the recently developed emotion concept in our culture that we call putting on your game face. Also, Filipino, gigil, the urge to hug or squeeze something that is unbearably adorable. From Norwegian, forelsket, an intense joy of falling in love. From the Danish, hygge, a certain feeling of close friendship. From the Russian, toka, which is spiritual anguish. From the Portuguese, saudade, a strong spiritual longing. From the Spanish, pena ajena, sadness over another person's loss, discomfort or embarrassment for someone else's behalf. From the Japanese, arigata mewaku, the feeling that someone has done you a favor that you didn't want from them and which may have caused difficulty for you, but you're required to be grateful anyway. Doesn't that sound very Japanese? The culture is its concepts, and the concepts for the way we feel, plus the physiological sensations we're interpreting, are the emotion. Also, I love this one from the Japanese. Age atore is the feeling that you just had a haircut and now look worse. Other cultures mix and match emotion categories differently. For the Ifaluk of Micronesia, there's phago, which depending on context could mean love or empathy or pity, sadness or compassion. And from the Czech, litost is torment over one's own misery combined with the desire for revenge. We might want to revive twitterpated from the 1942 Disney movie Bambi. Twitterpated, like chipless, is a made-up emotion, but they're all made up. And that is Barrett's point. All emotions are made up by members of a given culture. Your emotional life is cultural habits of interpretation of and projection onto your awareness of your body states. As we work through the meaning of this new understanding of emotion, it's going to have wide implications. It's going to have legal implications, like we can't tell what remorse is. Remorse is a culture product, and some cultures have very different expressions of it, or don't have the concept at all. So the notion of remorsefulness in criminal sentencing is problematic, and yet juries decide sentences in part on whether they think the defendant feels remorse. Dzhokhar Tsarnaev of Chechnya, the surviving bomber of the 2013 Boston Marathon bomb, was sentenced to death in 2015. Tsarnaev spoke words of apology, but when jurors looked at his face, all they saw was a stone-faced stare. If Lisa Feldman Barrett is right, then jurors do not and cannot detect remorse or any other emotion in anybody ever. Neither can I, and neither can you, she says. That might be someone who is a remorseless killer, but a stone-faced stare might also mean that someone is stoically accepting defeat, which is, in fact, what Chechen culture prescribes for someone in Dzhokhar Tsarnaev's situation. There's solid reason to believe Dzhokhar Tsarnaev committed the acts of which he was accused. There is no basis for saying he was remorseless or that he wasn't. There's a lot more to say about how to understand emotions, but let me leave you with two takeaways. One, learn more emotion concepts. Emotional granularity, having a higher vocabulary of emotion words, is healthy for you. Yes, they are all cultural concepts, but it's good to have a large toolbox of cultural concepts. The ability to speak and think with greater precision is a brain efficiency for navigating your reality. And we humans have created a fantastically complex social reality for ourselves. So your brain needs all the efficiency it can get. And second, whatever you're feeling, you don't have to take it so seriously. And particularly, you don't have to take it serious. You don't have to take seriously your interpretation of what you think other people are feeling. Talk to the people. Ask them what they're feeling. Don't assume. They'll make up a story, but at least it's the better story than the one you're making up about them. Emotions are social, so be sociable with them and about them. And good luck. It's a rough terrain out there. Blessed be. Amen.